good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday. It is the 17th of July. Summer's going quickly. Mm. I know you all know that, but
sadly,
summer is going
sadly.
Very quickly. And but it, here we are. It's
winter's
the 17th
coming.
Of... I already know Bob is stocked up on the tuna fish, so I don't even have to ask about that. It's the 17th of July. I hope you're all well and safe and have power. The storms that came through the area that were awful in a lot of places. And up in my neck of the woods in Washington County, but in Saratoga County and Warren County, got banged up pretty good. I know other areas certainly did. And a lot of people without power. And a lot of people taking the chainsaw to get the tree off the car or the shed or whatever. So I hope you're safe and made it through. And this is our weather pattern we're in. So we'll make the best of it. And then in one of God's great ironies, we drive in this morning and it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Stunningly gorgeous. The sun is shining so bright you can see all of the things that were ruined last night. We welcome you to the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a terrific group of panelists this morning and are going to go into a lot of areas. I think to those days every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, but every once in a while I'm just sitting in my office at home and I'm going through and I'm trying to find stories for the next day. And I'm like, I just don't know. I gotta find five and I'm only up with to two. And then yesterday, there's a lot. There's a lot. So we'll try to get to as many as we possibly can with this terrific group. We welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Hello, Vera.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Joe. Joe found my reading glasses. I was so pleased this morning. I thought, oh, my God. I drove my husband mad going through the cabin, going through the house from top to bottom. It was ridiculous, and I was like, where are my glasses? And you delivered this morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm only sorry I didn't find them sooner, but I'm glad they have been reunited to you.
Me too.
And I'm glad you can read again.
I know. I was like, wow, how are we going to handle this?
I haven't read the news for days.
She's not that lucky.
Dean, yeah. Right, that's right. Yeah. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University of Albany, Bob Griffin is here. I called Bob on Monday and I said, hey, we're going to do a special show from 11 to 12. Can you come and join us? And Bob said, absolutely. And I thank you very much for that. I'm glad you were available.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And it was, I think, important to have your voice then as it is now. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Yeah, I'm just thinking about all the people who don't have power. And for folks that weren't affected by the storms last night, you know, take 10 minutes and check the batteries on your flashlights and, you know, make sure that you've got your necessary supplies. And for folks that lost trees, if they're near power lines, don't mess with them. Please call them in. So be safe, everybody.
Homeland Security at work.
That's right. You know, this October, I will have been married to my dear wife for 30 years. And I don't remember and I say this since COVID when she started working from home. But now when I get home, this is sort of the rundown I get. I put all of our devices, and they're all charging right now. Everything is being, and I've put the extra pots of water in. Well, what are you doing? Like, this is amazing. This is great. The mattresses are downstairs. I have the crate ready to go down the stairs. I was like, wow, okay.
Joe Donahue's going to the mattresses.
Yeah, I was like, yes.
Fantastic. Totally different meeting.
This is amazing. I mean, she's always been like proactive, but this is like, wow, this is very, very cool.
And it's not even Texas or Florida.
No. I was getting. I was at physical therapy yesterday when all the stuff was going and the storms were going on, and Kelly's texting me, just stay where you are, stay in place. I will allow you. I'll let you know when you're allowed to go. To travel from point A to point B. So,
that's fine. That's great.
Very good. I thank her. Anna Markowitz is here, an advanced lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. If anybody, if the campaign is sending anybody out, Anna is often right knee deep in all of that. I can't imagine what your life's been like the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it has been exciting. You know, I thought I was going to be on the road this week, and then things changed because of all of the news that's happening. But, you know, we have to do what we have to do to get Democrats elected. So sometimes you need to go back and figure out your messaging. So, but here I am.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad it all worked out. And Anna wrote me and said, false alarm. And I was like, oh, thank God. So, because she had said she couldn't come. So, fantastic. It's great to have you all here. Welcome. We, of course, welcome you, the audience, the home audience, and those playing the home version of the game. we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. There are a million stories in the Naked City. We could start with any one of them, which would be appropriate. And we'll get to a lot of stuff this morning. I would like to start, especially since Bob is here, to talk about the Trump investigation, the shooting investigation into the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump that took place on Saturday in Butler, Pennsylvania. There has been more information. As I mentioned, Bob was with us on Monday, which I greatly appreciated. We did not know a lot of information at that point. Since then, more information, obviously, has come to light about, we don't know, we still, lot of questions, right. but we know a little bit more than we knew before. And so what we're seeing, and I think we even alluded to this on Monday, so here we are on Wednesday, and this is not changed, and that is this pointing of fingers between local forces and the Secret Service and this dispute. So what we're learning is that at the rally, local police and the gunman were in the same warehouse complex. So the Secret Service was on the literal ground, and the shooter was outside and then up a ladder and on the roof of the building that the Secret Service was in. And the director of the Secret Service said the local forces were in the very same building, an account suggesting that the gunman was essentially on top of them. A local law enforcement official told the New York Times on Tuesday that was not the case and that the local officers were in an adjacent building. The discrepancy in their accounts is just one unsettled element in the effort to determine how security broke down and allowed a 20-year-old with a semi-automatic rifle to open fire in a rapid barrage that left Mr. Trump hurt, one man dead, two other people at the rally gravely wounded. That this simple matter, whether law enforcement used the same building as the gunman, is still not easily resolved 3 days after the shooting, shows that divisions are emerging among the law enforcement agencies after a would-be assassin came close to felling the Republican presidential nominee 2 days before the party's convention. We bring in the name of Kimberly Cheadle, the Secret Service director. Set off the back and forth in an interview on ABC on Tuesday, her first public appearance since the assassination attempt. She said the local officers were inside the building used by the gunman. And if so, that meant the gunman could have scaled the building even as snipers were stationed inside of it. So there seems to be finger pointing. I said this yesterday, Bob, and I'm interested. I think what I said was correct, but please let me know if not. But even if local law enforcement was responsible for securing that outer perimeter, does it not fall on the Secret Service to make sure that that work was completed and completed successfully?
Yes, and Cheadle walked back her comments yesterday afternoon, saying that the Secret Service was in charge. And I can tell you from past experiences working, you know, when I was the fire chief down in Loudoun County, Virginia, when the president came to the county, the Secret Service was always in charge. We were part of unified command, but we all operated under the umbrella of the Secret Service. it was, I thought it was a poor statement on her part, because she knows that the Secret Service was empowered to have primacy in that situation. I think it caused divides, frankly, that didn't need, and I think it added more confusion to it. I understand in part some of the wording issues of where people are located, because we're talking about a huge complex of buildings when I was looking at the pictures. So you could have actually had law enforcement in that complex, and in my mind it would be similar to saying, you know, there are people on a university campus. It's a huge campus, mm-hmm. like, you know, so being specific about where they were. We also do know that they were vectoring law enforcement towards the shooter prior to shots being fired. Heard some
vectoring meaning
that that law enforcement had, you know, the reports that I saw yesterday were law enforcement had been told, you know, a minute and a half before that this guy was there, and had dispatched units to go check that out, check out what it was.
But meanwhile, we also have reports that minutes, 10 minutes before this happened, that there were observers, people who were at the event, that were looking and seeing a guy walking around the building with a ladder.
Yes.
And told both, and there is some discrepancy mm-hmm. in this, told Secret Service as well as local law enforcement. I initially heard the Secret Service say, well, we can't respond to people are very, like, if you see something, say something. So a lot of people do that, and most of those turn out to be nothing. But by the same token, that the people were pleading, like, there he is, you know, mm-hmm. he's with a ladder. And then, so for that to not sort of kick in as another aspect of this.
Joe, I've never been at an event with POTUS, or in this case, the former president of the United States, where there weren't way more resources than you need. There is always resources available, and a situation like that should have been responded to immediately. I listened to John Miller on CNN this morning, I like him very. I mean, I like him personally, but I thought his comments were interesting too. His reporting about him, the shooter walking around with a rangefinder. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that don't know what that is, it's something that both golfers and shooters use as a way of determining, you know, how far a distance is. But it triggered, you know, the initial reports are this triggered enough curiosity that was flagged for law enforcement. And you have the issue of the ladder that you just raised, which I thought was interesting, is that they still haven't found the ladder. Mm-hmm. So they're still trying to figure out how he even got up on the roof. And then when you add the complexity of a known threat from Iran, which doesn't seem to be at this point connected to the actual shooting.
So we haven't discussed this yet. This came out yesterday in fact, it was about 10 minutes after, and both Fred Hoff and Jim Ketterer sent me these notes going, oh, my God, we didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
So there was increased security was called for because of a threat from Iran.
Not only a threat, but a viable threat. Iran threatens all the time. This was considered to be a viable threat that changed. You know, the Secret Service now saying that it changed their security posture. In which case, it raises questions for me. Like, okay, if that changed your security posture, then why didn't you push back the perimeter? Why didn't you, if you knew this was there, then there should have been even more resources there. So I think this is adding to the complexity of this whole situation. And while we know a little bit more today, we still are very unclear on motive, intent, and if this is indeed a standalone. There are lots of unanswered questions.
I want to go to Anna here too, because I mean, you do this. This
yeah,
is what
yeah.
you do, and you work
with
Secret Service and setting up these events. And yeah. and I guess for both of you, I mean, the question is, how could any building that is, and I've heard different things on this, but 450 feet away yeah. from the spot where 450 to 500 feet from where the president was speaking,
yep.
of how that becomes the outer perimeter?
Yeah, I was personally shocked that there wasn't a counter sniper on that roof. I've done a lot of events for the president, for the vice president. I've never done an event for a former president, so perhaps they don't have as many snipers that are available to be on roofs. It could have just been that they only had a few and they had to pick strategically which ones they wanted to put them on and thought they could delegate this to law enforcement to cover it. But I was personally shocked. There is normally, as Bob said, just, you know, a plethora of assets that are being deployed. And I wonder if it really was kind of a sweet spot in a lack of security because Trump hadn't secured the RNC nomination yet. I know that former presidents get less security than current sitting presidents, and official nominees get more security than a potential candidate, and it could have just been the sweet spot where they maybe didn't have quite enough assets to go around.
But one of the things, so I'm just going by an aerial photo, and I don't know what I'm talking about, but just from viewing this, one of the things that struck me was from the aerial view taken moments after the shooting, there were maybe two cars in the parking lot of that building. So that means they weren't letting cars in,
right?
But people were there, which I don't really understand that. And you would think even if it were law enforcement or security or Secret Service, that those vehicles would be there. Some emergency vehicles would be there.
That usually is crawling with public safety vehicles. This is what doesn't make any sense to me.
We're good. We're good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, there are plenty of resources. I mean, all they have to do is ask, and it's not unusual. In fact, it's actually promoted this idea of, you know, when you have an event where the Secret Service is involved, or even a national security event like the Super Bowl, okay. There is unified command, but the expectation in practice is that there's federal, state, and local police presence. There is, though, a single command structure so that you don't have people working cross purposes. It includes emergency medical services, EMS. It includes fire. It includes law enforcement. It usually, you know, if they needed sniper, if they needed more resources, they could have deployed National Guard resources. So I actually don't think it's going to be an issue of were they available. The question is, did they deploy enough, and how did they create this blind spot? They created a blind spot in their security perimeter. That raises really significant questions, which I think in the future means that they're going to be pushing that envelope even further out, which is the way it should have been.
Vera?
So in my view, there were two fundamental problems. Number one, venue choice. Preferably you have big events like that in an indoor space where you control entrances, where you could check people more thoroughly than was able at this particular location. Including, I've read about vegetation that was in the way and may have caused problems of visibility for some of the
sight
snipers.
Sight lines for snipers with
exactly.
Trees and so forth.
So
right.
I think it was probably Trump's team decision to speak there, and maybe, now they're more careful about selecting certain locations. I think that is also something we should consider. Secondly, I think, as both Anna and Mark Bob said, was that they had a communication issue. And I think they may not have practiced with the local police in that area consistently. I mean, they may have had some exposure to trainings, but if you don't do this regularly, I think it's difficult. You know, just because you have certain ways through which you have your orders flow and your command structure, and if local police was not as well trained as maybe a Secret Service, you could have some miscommunications, some miscues, or following different orders. I mean, it all will come out, but I think communication and venue choice are two of the fundamental issues as well.
Another issue is that it could come down to cost, too, that yeah. you know, these are very expensive events to put on, uh-huh. so being outside is actually less expensive than being inside. There are a lot of factors that they were going to have to investigate to make sure that we can fix.
So let me ask one more question before we go to a break, and whoever wishes to respond to this. But I assume there are many goals when it comes to security. One, of course, of the Secret Service is to protect the in this case the former president of the United States, the candidate. Who is ultimately responsible for the security of the people at the event, the attendees of the event?
The Secret Service is in charge of the event, of all security at the event. While the primacy is the principal, they still have control of that event. That's why they bring in state and local and other assets. You still have a unified command, but it's still the Secret Service's. So Secret Service is going to be in charge of that event.
So they're as worried about the man in the third row with his family who was shot and killed.
Definitely not. I mean, their main objective is to keep their protectee safe. And I think that they do that by making sure that there aren't any guns or knives or metal objects or heavy water bottles to throw. They really kind of secure what goes into the site. And so they think kind of through that, it's securing the entire site. But I think with this outside venue.
The only thing I would differ is that the incident commander doesn't step aside because they got Trump off the stage. That's the only thing that they'd still be vectoring resources in. Mm. They're still going to be responsible. They now have an active crime scene. At some point, there's a point where then the active crime scene would convert over to the FBI as being the lead agency, but also having state and locals also involved. So that would be the only argument. You're right. They're going to be more concerned about getting Trump off the stage, but they are going to still be concerned about the scene. I mean, so they don't just give up
on it
because
their
person is gone.
Which is why the shooter was neutralized as quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if we will ever find out exactly what took place. If this is something that is not to the benefit of the FBI or local law enforcement to disclose all the details, right?
I'm actually confident that what they'll do is they'll do a complete rewrite of their protocols.
Absolutely,
because any time that they find a breach, they, regardless of who's in office, they will do a major.
But we will as a public not find out how they change or anything, right?
You only see a very small piece of what the protocols are.
So I went to see Hootie and the Blowfish the other night, and I went into the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, and I went through a metal detector. I was wanded. Uh-huh. I was patted down, as most of the people were.
And that was just in the parking lot.
Yeah, that was hell. that was my date.
And you still got your pocket knife in or something?
No, but then when I got down to my seats, which were pretty good.
Yeah.
They took any cans or even bottles away and poured the ushers had to pour the contents into a paper cup before they weren't letting anybody anywhere near with any kind of item. And I just thought, you know, I thought of this the other day of just that you wouldn't think that security would be tighter at a Hootie and the Blowfish concert than an event where a former president of the United States
was
speaking.
I'm sure inside the event, it was just as secure as back, I would hope.
Yeah.
Double. I think that it was just a miscommunication about where the perimeter of the event is. And I'm sure that they're never going to do that again. I think that if there is a building that is within shooting range of the candidate or elected official, they are going to be having a sniper on that roof for all of time now.
Or visibility disruption. You can have, you know, all kinds of, walls, elevated or something that disrupts some kind of an assassination attempt. Yeah.
Yeah. I did an event in for the Tappan Zee Bridge, and when Obama was speaking, they were worried, Secret Service was worried that someone was going to be on a Metro North train riding north and would have a shot. And, I mean, the amount of effort it would take to time a train, Godspeed, I've taken a lot of Metro North trains. I wouldn't be able to pull that off. But we had to put a huge flag to block the line of sight. And so I think that they it's weird to me that that didn't happen for this event.
And that seems like a communication issue, right?
Yeah.
I mean, somebody
didn't see that threat. Someone didn't see that as a threat.
All they do, not all they do, but a lot of things they do is like they imagine they look at the site and they imagine the potential for where an attack could come from. And for having that experience that you just described and not having a flag or not having some visibility disruptor there is astounding.
We have to take a break. But again, even with not having that up there, that I would think at the moments before the rally begins and before the general public comes in, that there's a time where there's a checklist where everybody goes through and says, this is everything we need to do is in place.
Yes.
And where you would notice things that were not taken care of.
You'd be there hours and hours in advance. Mm-hmm. We can talk about it when we get back.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We do welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
I'm sitting in the fading light with my back against the wall.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we are talking this morning at the first topic of that conversation having to do with security at the site where former President Donald Trump was the subject of an assassination attempt on late Saturday afternoon in Butler, Pennsylvania. Vera Carius Kelly is here, Bob Griffin and Anna Markowitz, and we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. From Bruce, we get this letter. The panel is ignoring the fact that a Secret Service sniper killed the shooter as soon as they observed him. The issue is why the snipers did not observe and take actions sooner. And I would only counter to Bruce, which is, it seems to me, the issue is why the guy got up there in the first, how he got up there in the first place, right?
Yeah. You know, and you know, Bruce, you're right. I mean, the snipers did what they are supposed to do. The question is, why was he even in a position to be able to take a shot? And it raises a lot of questions in my mind too. I mean, think about somebody crawling on a white roof with a long gun. I mean, a rifle. It's not like it was in his pocket or anything. I mean, so how did he get that far up? Yeah. I mean, how did he breach security? There's so many questions here.
Yep, communication and visibility issues, and you know, there's so many questions.
According to protocol, he never should have been able to take the shot. I do want to go back, and if can I toss Vera a question, Joe?
Yeah.
Or a comment? Could you talk a little bit? I mean, the Iranian piece of it is really interesting to me because this is in response to drone attacks on the Iranian general, I think. Right.
General Soleimani was, you know, I mean, that was a hit on a foreign general, somebody who led the Revolutionary Guards in Iran, had a long history of carrying out terrorist attacks, assassination attempts, you know, controlled all of the military affairs that involved foreign adventures in Iran, including Hezbollah, including Hamas connections. And so this was a major assassination attempt, or there was a major assassination carried out by the U.S. So the Iranians, however, have talked for a long time about taking revenge. And usually what they do is they send drones to bomb U.S. facilities in Iraq or Syria or other locations. They have not really made it to the U.S. in terms of the, you know, our current land. And they've always attacked military bases or military personnel elsewhere. Now, we know the Iranians have a long history of carrying out assassinations in Europe, including in Germany. Mm-hmm. They've gone after people viciously that were in, diaspora and trying to hide from the regime. So it's very interesting to see this threat. Now, the Iranians have a new president. He's not known to have engaged in behavior like that, but we have to see what the relationship is between this new president, the supreme leader who's running the show, and the military. So I am not 100% convinced that the Iranians really are planning to carry out anything, but they talk a lot. They talk a lot. There are a lot of threats, and I think the threats are real in the vicinity of the Iranian territory and in the region. I think if the Iranian attacks tick up, we'll see that in Europe first, and then the United States potentially.
I don't necessarily think it's going to be there. I mean, mm-hmm. This may be one of these situations where these two events are, I think, unrelated, but they come mm-hmm. together. But it's not good for future relationships with Iran.
But they know the future relationships will be bad. I mean,
But it's even worse when countries start trying to knock off.
Oh yeah, I mean,
world leaders.
Yes, apparently this is something that presidents can now do on a regular basis, according to the Supreme Court. So this may be permissible now, and there will be no review. It's part of the political process now that we've done it. I mean, let's just be real.
It all comes back US to that Supreme Court.
The U.S. has done it before, multiple times throughout history. This is not new, Since the 50s, there have been lots and lots of assassination of foreign leaders, and now it's apparently not even reviewable.
So to me, and again, I don't understand fully the intricacies of all of what goes into the security of an event. But so at one point, it came out yesterday that the U.S. detected potential Iranian plot to kill Trump. And yes, Bob, they say that's separate from Saturday's shooting, but they also said that that led to increased security for the president. So we're talking about, they're saying there's increased security, and for the first 40 minutes of the show, we talked about how there was a lack of security.
Right, which again, I think makes little sense to me, and it's something that the Secret Service is going to have to defend. Mm-hmm. I would have thought just because of the it was viable intelligence that was pointing towards the Iranian threat that would have pushed back the envelope, the security envelope, even further than it was.
Yeah. We had a panelist yesterday, Fred Hoff, who said that he believed that the head of the Secret Service should tender her resignation. We have a letter from Carrie who says this woman should have been fired on Sunday morning. The head of the Secret Service blamed local police for the screw-up and then went on to say the roof was too steep, didn't want to endanger her agents. How do you feel about that?
Let me sort of separate it. Too steep is not an answer. I think that they should have had somebody there.
Wasn't too steep for the shooter.
No, as far as the resignation, I disagree because I think what that does is it just creates more organizational chaos. I think after the dust has settled, that she should resign. It was a failure on behalf of her organization. And when you accept leadership of the organization, you accept all of the perks that go with it. You need to be responsible party. And this was a failure by the Secret Service.
Yeah, but I do agree. A review has to happen first. We don't just get rid of people without fully reviewing what took place step by step, bottom up, and to just sort of, this is sort of a reactionary behavior to get rid of leadership and appoint somebody new who may have similar issues, right? So let's just review what happened and then see if she should resign or if she gets fired.
I just also had this thought that in firing her, and I don't know that may be justified, but during an investigation where you probably want to find the person who is making the decisions to have them involved in the process, if there is an independent investigation, then they that may not be the smartest thing to do. But I don't know.
Well, then you replace her. You know, okay. So say Biden says, "All right, off with your head," because you didn't do your job. Her deputy moves up. But maybe you may find that the deputy was more responsible for the failure than she was. This is why take it slow, okay? Be thorough, okay? You don't want to rush this right now because you want to make sure that we're actually digging through all of the elements so we can understand, so we can make sure we're doing everything in our power to make sure it can't be replicated.
I do think that she shouldn't step down because I think that this is going to fix itself. Like, they're not going to make the same mistake again. And I think that it was a miscommunication. I think that they thought that area of buildings were secured by local law enforcement. They thought that they were going to keep out all of the people from all of those buildings, and somehow people got in. And I'm not blaming anybody, but, you know, it's just what happened. And I think it's human error. I think that on paper, they were like, this is covered by law enforcement. This is covered by service. And it'll work out, and it didn't, and so now they're all pointing fingers at each other, and it's unfortunate, and I don't think it'll happen again.
But she hasn't helped with the finger pointing. Yeah. I mean, she's been very vocal and looking at the local law enforcement, and I just, you know, whether she should step down or not, but it just seems like the communication, even after the event, has been spotty.
Yeah, I remember when I was when I was the fire chief, I had a scene that was going really bad, and you know, in hindsight, if everything turned out fine, but if it hadn't, then that should have cost me my job.
Yeah,
I mean that's part of the responsibility of leadership, and I think the same way that for individual agents who if they made mistakes will be penalized.
Yeah.
Then the management should be penalized as well. That's where I don't think it needs to be immediate, and I think it needs to be in a way that doesn't affect the operations of the overall organization. But I do think it is of a level that does raise enough questions about her leadership that she shouldn't be running the organization.
And I have to say also, when a human life is lost and two other people are severely injured, this requires a serious review because, I mean, we can't just think of the main asset. We also have to think of the security of the overall venue. And if I was a family member of somebody who was shot like that or injured severely and in a wheelchair or whatever is coming for those families, that is a grievous problem that needs to be addressed and investigated. So I think she'll probably end up finishing her career pretty soon.
Five letters, or 5 minutes and a bunch of letters to get to. So let me do that, and then we'll move on to another topic on the other side of the break. Dan says, it's frankly unbelievable that Trump was allowed to stand up exposed and pump his fist seconds after being shot. Although the shooter was neutralized, how could the Secret Service be sure there weren't other shooters? This seems like an egregious lack of basic intelligence and, of course, provides red meat fodder for the conspiracist. I understand the letter, and I agree with it. I will say that as he's getting into the vehicle, those officers were all over him to put his hand down.
They were trying to shove him down.
Yeah, they were getting him down. I mean, they were aware of it. He may not have been aware of it, but they were certainly aware
of
it.
And it may have been extra strength because he had adrenaline pumping, and, you know, he had 5 agents around him, and they couldn't push him down initially. I mean, this is not as easy as people might think.
We're all doing the woulda, coulda, shoulda game about the security at the Trump rally, writes Claire, but very few have been talking about the real problem. There are 200 million guns in the United States of America. In retrospect, the shooter looks like a troubled young man, but there are probably millions of kids like him. Do we lock up all the loners? Do we spend billions of dollars securing places like SPAC? The shooter could not have done this unless he had easy access to a military weapon, gun control now. Well, I agree. And the only thing I disagree with is that I think we have been talking about this a great deal. I don't think necessarily the Republicans want to talk about it because they have the little pins on their lapels of the very gun that was used to in the assassination.
Yeah,
attempt.
Because they think apparently they can use the guns to defend themselves, but when others use them, then that's a crime. So it's a very scary thing. I'm in favor of gun control, obviously. As a European, I'm used to other standards, I must say.
And I appreciate the point that the letter writer is making, but actually there are so many guns out there that gun control now isn't going to be the answer. The answer actually, unfortunately for someone like the Secret Service, is that they have got to look at a scene like this and say, because there's such a plethora of long guns with military-grade capabilities, that really changes your entire footprint and how you think about scene safety.
Let's go to someone with a name. Roz, who says, why wouldn't drones over the area be a regular part of the surveillance? Think of the detail, both long and short range, the entire venue to the color of the player's eyes you can get to see from overhead during a major football game.
Drones are used. I think when your principal is speaking, though, I would want, if I was a scene commander, I wouldn't want anything in the air, so that you know if anything is in the air, it's adversarial. I would argue that it's not a lack of technology. The Secret Service has plenty of technology. Their advanced team, and this goes back to a comment we made earlier about sight lines. Mm-hmm. Their advanced team should have been identifying issues with sight lines. And the Secret Service does have the ability to veto a site if they think it is unsafe, but they do use drones. They also use counter drone technologies as well. The Secret Service has all sorts of tools in a toolbox.
Carrie says it was reported that a local sheriff climbed onto the roof, saw the shooter, then retreated. Again, I don't know that was.
The reports that I have heard or seen from multiple sources. So, when I say multiple sources, Joe, I don't know if they're definitive or they're all repeating the same issue.
Right.
But as the way I understood it is that they had seen the shooter up there. They had dispatched an officer, a sheriff's deputy. He's climbing the ladder. That the shooter did take did turn towards the officer who moved down the ladder to get out of the sight line, and that's when the shots were fired.
Now, so the question the letter writer is asking is, shouldn't that local law enforcement officer have shot him immediately, or would they have had to communicate that to Secret Service?
So if the law enforcement, and again, let's everybody picture this. Okay, you're at the climbing a ladder up to a tall roof, and you're not necessarily going to have your gun in your hand. So you've got the physics of how do you get into a firing position? How do you have your weapon out? I can say that if the law enforcement officer saw a shooter with a gun on the roof, and felt that public safety was endangered, which I would argue that is definitely endangerment to public safety, and that person actually took an aggressive move towards you, they would have every right to have shot himself. And that's the attorneys would fight that out, but I would say that would have been well within their right to do.
All right, we are we're going to move on to other topics. When we come back from a break, we have much more to discuss. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, Anna Markowitz, Robert Griffin, and Vera Karius-Kelly with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A vibrant discussion this morning, and we welcome you to be a part of it. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Akarius-Kelly, is here. Robert Griffin, who we call Bob,
thank you,
is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, and Anna Markowitz, an advanced lead for the White House and former Chief of Staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former Assistant County Executive for Pat Ryan. We're going to go to 11 o'clock this morning. We'll go extra innings so we can get a lot in and welcome your letters, because there is, as I mentioned at the top of the show, much to talk about. So we haven't spent some time really in passing discussing this, but we really haven't talked about it. And I know it is a topic that is touchy with our listening audience. But the question becomes about President Biden. We've talked a lot about President Trump in the last several days, of course. Not only because of the assassination attempt, but because of the Republican National Convention taking place in Milwaukee. But we look at an article in this morning's New York Times that says the Biden circle shrinks as Democrats fear an election wipeout. The President Biden, increasingly isolated during the biggest political crisis of his presidency, is in a historic standoff with his party. You saw Adam Schiff come out, not come out, but to talk to his supporters and say that we are going to probably lose everything, meaning the presidency, the House and the Senate. So then in this article, it talks about President Biden post-debate becoming, with the chaos of that, really relying on his closest consultants, but not with people even within the White House, more so in members of his family, a tight-knit group that includes his son Hunter and the First Lady Jill Biden. And Mr. Biden has not consulted directly with the pollsters on his 500-person campaign team about the state of the race against Donald Trump, but has instead relied on Mike Donilon, a longtime friend, former pollster, and Biden campaign managing guru, messaging guru, to summarize the numbers with regular memos and numerous daily calls. The ever-buzzing phone of Steve Ricchetti, a close counselor to Mr. Biden since his vice presidency, is the main conduit between concerned lawmakers and the president. But while all this swirls around, the concern is, and the reality seems to be, that the president is becoming more and more insulated to the calls on the outside, and is regularly, as late as Monday with Lester Holt, saying that he is in this race and that 15 million people voted for him in the primaries, and that is an indicator that they want him to continue. So I bring this up because it is a battle that is continuing and one that some wonder if will continue in earnest once the Republican National Convention is over. Anna.
Yeah, I am nervous, as is every human that I've talked to in the last few weeks. I think people are extremely nervous that we don't have a candidate that will win. But I also don't know who the candidate is who will win. And so I think I'm personally torn. I'm kind of disheartened that there's so much negative news kind of tearing down Biden that I don't know how he recovers just from the news cycles alone. I feel like we're kind of tearing down our own house before we have another house to move into. I just want us to win. I want us to have a candidate that can beat Donald Trump, whoever that is. I will knock doors and, you know, get out the vote for that person. And if that's Kamala, great. I think that she would do an amazing job. I think that she's had some moments that might make younger people more apt to vote for her, like her call for the ceasefire, her stance on abortion rights. I think that she could fill that void, but I also want to make sure that she's ready for it and make sure that she can, in fact, win before we give up on our current candidate, because we have a little over 100 days until the election, and that is an alarming time to be switching candidates. So I just urge us to take a deep breath, to get out the vote for anybody who's on the ticket, and to just, you know, try to keep democracy at the center of our thoughts.
President Biden, of course, is saying that almost exactly what you're saying is that we need to just continue to keep the focus on Trump. But part of the problem is that he's saying that I'm the only person who can do this. And that is enraging those who are out there. Mm-hmm. As the money is, and I say this as a fact, that the money is drying up. The money that is coming into the Biden campaign, major donors have stopped or at least put it on hold.
I think that he sees this as similar to his moment in the primary in 2020 when he was told he could never win, that there was no path to victory. And then all of a sudden, South Carolina came around and all of a sudden, oh, well, he's the guy. And that's how he has this reputation of being the comeback kid, that he has been told time after time that, like, there is no possible way. And then it works out for him anyway. And so I think he's seeing this through that angle. Like, if I just hang on, this is just a brief moment. I had a bad debate, but people will come back around when they realize that I am the only one that can win this. And I think that there are a lot of people who are saying that this isn't that moment. Yeah. That moment has happened before, but that isn't right now. And I think that members of Congress, such as Pat Ryan, who called out as the eighth person in Congress to say, hey, you've done a great job, Joe Biden, but now is not your time. I think that people like him are worried not only will we lose the presidency, but we'll end up losing the House because we'll end up losing races like his that are really tight. And
very
if people
close.
Don't turn out, then we could be handing him not only the presidency, but full control of the Senate and House, which is alarming. And so I think people are rightfully nervous. I just don't know if we have a clear path forward.
The inner circle issue is a one of the big problems for me. I feel the exact same way as you just described, Anna. I just worry who he's listening to, what voices he's not recognizing, and if he's sort of, you know, imagining himself as the comeback kid permanently, and he doesn't hear different constituencies the way he used to in the past. And I think he has sort of, because he's sort of circled, you know, his inner circle is sort of surrounding him, guarding him, protecting him. Jill Biden is doing this. Hunter is doing it, his advisors. And I'm really concerned that weakens our chances because he's just not hearing what a lot of people say. He's very defensive in some ways.
Well, there's a paragraph in this New York Times article that says, on Friday, Mr. Biden abruptly left a call with Hispanic members of the House after one lawmaker, Representative Mike Levin of California, called on him to get out of the race. Three participants familiar with the call said questions were pre-selected by Mr. Biden's staff. Now, I will say that while a White House spokesman called that claim false, several people have corroborated that story. That's disturbing, it seems. I mean, if you're pre-selecting what you're hearing and you're only letting the candidate hear from those who agree with your decision.
So a couple of thoughts, Joe, and I actually do have a slightly positive spin.
Oh, good.
Okay. Oh, go on.
Not yet. At the end, I'm going to tease everybody. First, an observation is that, you know, think about both candidates. I mean, we've talked about their age and their infirmities. If their life coaches are Hunter Biden and Eric Trump, could it get any worse for us? Okay, I just need to put that out there
that was supposed to be positive?
No. I didn't get the positive.
I missed the positive.
The irony about, and I picked up that paragraph too, and what gets me is what Biden needs to do is that he needs to show vibrancy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he needs to show the vibrancy of a 50 or 60-year-old, not an 80-year-old. And when you hear, okay, I'm doing an event, and then you're hearing that it's kabuki theater and it's completely orchestrated, it raises even more doubts in my mind about his capacity. And I am part of the group, I think, that has sort of a growing frustration with him and the people around him who feel like they're putting his legacy at risk, but more importantly, they're putting the nation and our future at risk. And the window is closing so fast that if changes are going to be made, they need to be made quickly. Here's the positive piece, though. If you think about the election cycle, this should be the lowest point, you hope, for Biden and the Democrats. There's enthusiasm. We just came off this situation on Saturday you couldn't have scripted that for Trump, and then coming victoriously into it. I was actually surprised that he announced the vice president candidate, because they're using all of their chits right now. So this should be the lowest point. So a vibrant, aggressive Joe Biden getting out on the campaign trail, really hitting it hard, there is an opportunity. But if these are scripted events that end at 4:30 because that's when the early bird special ends, it's not going to play well. The other thing too is I worry about who Biden's listening to, because I think about what Carvel's saying and Axelrod, and I think, Joe, I need you talking to Obama. you've got Obama and Clinton. You've got people who you could talk to. You need to get beyond Jill and Hunter.
Well, so that brings up a question. I don't know if anybody has any insight into this, but I keep reading that he'll have meetings. And I think I read this correctly, that Schumer actually went to his house in Delaware.
Yep.
So what are they saying? Because it seems that I thought that was the whole point, that Hakeem Jeffries and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and even former President Obama would be going to him and saying, look, this is really serious, and this is what these are some of the things, maybe not telling him directly to get out, but this is the reality of where we are right now.
I would think that would be the case,
right?
But I mean, I don't think anybody's going on the record and saying what's happening in these meetings. So I think it's really hard to know what messages are being delivered and how they're being received.
And it might be, they're still somewhat deferential to him and not as direct as they need to be. But I have a distinct feeling that that's going to intensify. And if he does not step aside, we're going to have a contested convention.
See, and I think the convention is pretty much going to be locked in. I unfortunately really do. I think that unless Biden can see the situation the way a lot of the rest of us see the situation, unless he agrees to it, the convention is locked, and this is the way it's going to be. And what really worries me is that. Where I'm sitting, all Trump needs to do to win is just keep his mouth shut. And I know it's hard for the guy. I mean, so I still have hope. I still have hope in his.
He'll do something
crazy. Good luck on that.
Yeah.
But, all right.
But if you really think about it, he's since the debate, he has been remarkably quiet.
Yep.
And right now, is where I'm looking at it. All he's got to do is just shut his mouth and. Yeah.
He's trying to become the unity candidate, which where did that one come from?
I'm sorry, it was supposed to be the unity, the national unity was supposed to be yesterday, too, and that was a complete crap show in Milwaukee. Yeah.
And he chose an attack dog of the worst kind as his VP, so this is not unity.
Oh, yeah, the Yale hillbilly?
Yeah.
And the first person to come out and point the figure at point the finger at Joe Biden as being the reason the assassination attempt moments after it happened. However, this has been the problem since the debate, right? You can get away with that if the Democrats and the candidate of and Biden aren't saying anything, aren't doing anything, and are doing the hand-wringing and speaking in private. A few people have, what's the number now, 12, 14 that have come out in the House and Senate, have come out and said that he should step aside. But by all accounts, that number is a lot higher. It's just people who are willing to say the words.
Well, think about, you know, one of the themes from yesterday at the convention was Make America Safe Again. You know, and I'm thinking, okay, when I hear that, what do I think? I say, well, make America safe again from a corrupt Supreme Court. Make America safe again from unhinged gun access, from women dying because they don't have basic health care, from born-again pastors who blame 12-year-old children for tempting them, from members of Congress who traffic minors, from pro-Russian candidates. I mean, there's so much wrong with this party, with the Republican Party, with Trump, where Trump is taking this country, but we're not hearing any of it. I mean, when's the last time at the national level have we been hearing about the outrage about the lack of access to women's health care? Hmm. Fairness in taxation. I mean, there's so many of these issues.
So earlier we had a little bit of a conversation about the outcome of the French election, right? And we talked a little bit about how in Europe, people still have a historical memory of the hard right. And here it seems that we are very easily buying into propaganda and slogans and ideas that candidates don't really represent, but they broadly talk about something and individuals reinterpret the message that they think they want to hear. And they don't put it into the larger historical context of where this country has come from and where it's going. And this is what frightens me most, that many people are simply unaware of historical events, contexts, and manipulative messages. And, economic nationalism, as Trump advocates, is not a path forward. This is not going to help the working class. This is not going to help resolve poverty issues. Now, we can talk about potential policies that might be a combination of centrist and left ideas, but what the Republican Party advocates is elitism and benefits to the rich in a most direct way. And a lot of people don't seem to hear that message or don't seem to disentangle or may not have seen what develops in other countries following such policies. And since I've traveled a lot, I've seen the fallout from this, and it really scares me. And I'm hoping that people begin to really reflect on what the underlying messages are and who's supposed to benefit from this Republican Party.
Johnny writes, 4 months is a long time. Have you seen the polls? He is losing in every swing state. It is going to be a landslide if he stays in. Swap him out. And I think that is a point that Adam Schiff and others were making, are making yesterday, of pointing to those poll numbers.
But Joe, I mean, I'm looking at the poll. I looked at the 538 polls right before we came on the air, just because yes.
You study for the show?
I do.
Wow.
I do.
I love you all for doing that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was interesting is that the numbers still. You know, the problem I'm having with the polls is the numbers don't seem to move that much. I thought the numbers were going to move considerably after the debate, and they didn't. And I was talking to my wife about this, and I'm still not sure that the pollsters know how to poll anymore. Mm-hmm. There are of the swing states. The problem is there are more swing states now than there were.
Mm.
Right. And he's losing in every one of them.
And he's losing in almost every. There were a couple, I think, that he was still.
Initially he was losing in all but one, but he was still within the margin of error. That no longer seems to be the case. But also more perplexing, not perplexing, but more concerning, I think, for Democrats and for the Biden campaign is the fact that the poll that seems to be so relevant is that 76% of the people say that he's too old and shouldn't be the candidate.
Yeah.
How do you get around that?
Can I also toss another issue onto the table? Because I'd be interested in weaving this in.
Well, it's getting busy here, but sure.
The whole issue of Elon Musk and the $45 million a month that he has committed, and this
for Trump.
The strange alignment in my mind between, and J.D. Vance, despite all of his, you know, the way he wants to whitewash himself, you know, the Silicon Valley libertarian far right movement that we're seeing is really scary. But just I want people at home to think about that for a second, okay? For most of us, if you said $45 a month to donate to a political campaign, we'd be like, wow, that's money that I'm taking out of my family's pocket. $45 million this clown is putting forward, and it just shows you this confluence of badness, I think, it's going to impact our future.
It really is shocking how much money is in political campaigns in this country and how individuals that are wealthy run all kinds of things for us.
Not even trying to hide it, though.
They're not even trying to hide it anymore, right? That's why I'm such a supporter of short campaigns. Like Germany has 6 weeks. They have only allowed, you know, based on your support, a certain amount of money for advertising. It is not this drag out, knockout, 2-year campaign where all kinds of lies can be shared. Now, manipulation happens everywhere, but you know, if you limit it to 6 weeks, it's more contained. And here we can use social media, we can spread lies, we have media outlets that are propaganda arms of political parties. It is quite shocking to call this a model democracy, which I think it is no longer.
I mean, we just desperately need campaign finance reform.
Yeah,
people shouldn't be able to put $45 million into PACs and sway elections. It just shouldn't happen.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll take a couple letters on this subject, and then we'll move on to other subjects. We'll go up to the top of the hour, and we welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we have a great group that will continue with us through the top of the hour, Vera, Bob, and Anna. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. My thoughts go prowling round. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking still about Joe Biden and the shrinking of his inner circle that has become more familial than those who are work in the White House.
Yep.
And the decision of course, the president has made it very clear. He has made his decision. He is staying in the race. Although there are many, many Democrats who are pointing to polls to say that once again should be reconsidered. We do have letters like this one from Johnny, who says, with all due respect to polls, the polls haven't moved nationally. They have moved in the swing states in favor of Trump, and Biden is consistently running behind Senate candidates by 3, 4, 5 points, which suggests it's Biden that is the issue. Then we go to Linda, who says, love the show as always. I'm also worried about Biden winning a second term. My only advice is that everyone that was interested in having a Democratic candidate get into the White House in November, DNC.org, and start volunteering over the phone. Then Raina says, poll show the down ballot Democrats are doing better than Biden. It is candidate Biden who is slipping, not the Democratic Party. He still has time to prove he can run a hard race. But even during his well-received NAACP speech yesterday, he started to stumble and slur his words after about 5 minutes. I believe he is a great president, but a poor candidate. This is all very scary.
And I think this is, there are two issues I'll toss out, Joe. One, part of, Joe Biden has never been a great orator. All right. He's always been sort of a stumbling speaker. So unfortunately, right now, it's mm-hmm. under such a microscope that any mistake that is made is amplified. And I can tell you, going back and listening to shows that I've been on in the past, yeah. I'm like, wow, I sound like I had a stroke because I've left out all sorts of words in the sentence. I think we're expecting perfection, and this is the problem, though, is that he's created such an enthusiasm gap in my mind that I don't know how to overcome that. So I appreciate the letter about, you know, call and volunteer, but right now I'm like, I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling the love.
Well, I mean, and certainly for the down, and I think the point of that letter was for the down ballot races too, for the House and the Senate, and to work really hard in your community for what you can do.
Right.
I love this letter from Mary because I think it's a fundamental. I don't know how much this is the case, but mm-hmm. I'm going to read the letter, and I've thought about this a lot over the mm-hmm. last 2 weeks or so. What we hear is President Biden has decided not to drop out of the race. What is not being talked about is how competent Joe Biden is to make that decision, given his obvious cognitive decline. My experience with my husband in his early dementia is that he was not capable of good judgment and rational decision making. Mm. And I mean, I've seen that with people that I've known and people that I've loved, that you're expecting them to make a decision that they may not be capable of making. Mm. And how do you bridge that? And that is one of the things of that close knit circle of family would then be responsible, but often they're the last to realize how bad it is.
As I've said before, my I'm dealing with my mother's dementia, and it's heart wrenching, you grab on to every straw for hope, and unfortunately, when you start a decline, it doesn't get better. No. I mean,
you have some plateaus.
But think about the double standard that's going to happen, though. When Trump stumbles, it's not going to be about Trump's age. It's going to be, well, he was shot in the head, so you need to cut him slight. There is, it's not fair, and I'll just say that right out front. It is not fair, but there are two different standards right now between mm-hmm. what we're looking at for Donald Trump and what we're looking at for Joe Biden. And that's a burden that he's going to have to overcome.
And, you know, we're aware of the fact that Trump can't communicate in a clear sentence. You know, when you said earlier you feel like you're experiencing a stroke, I'm experiencing strokes listening to Trump because I don't even know what he's saying half the time. But we just say, oh, that's how he is. Whereas with Biden, we have a progression, right? And we're not sure where it's at. We don't know if he's being guarded by the inner circle and protected, and he has moments of clarity and he's slowly declining. We're not even sure about where he's at in this journey, and that makes us so nervous. I think that the lack of transparency, the lack of insight. We know Trump is a non-communicator and he has all kinds of issues that he's hiding, and health issues, and nobody speaks about that. But you know, unfortunately, the inner circle really has to start reflecting on what's most important. Is the country most important? Is Biden at a point where he actually still functions consistently at a high level? Or is there a slight decline that they're noticing? And they're not necessarily honest to themselves. Maybe that's what families do, right? You suffer through this pain.
Joe Biden looks, as a candidate, it seems that we're at a point where the definitive action is that if Joe Biden steps aside, that's a definitive action. That is an action that is you can't go back on. He's out. But the opposite to the decision is I'm staying in. Well, he's been saying I'm staying in for 3 weeks and no one's buying it. So that's a moving target in the sense of bad analogy, but in the sense of that in 2 weeks and in 4 weeks and in 8 weeks, if there is another episode, we're going to be right back where we were mm-hmm. 3 weeks ago, the day after the debate. That is not going to change. That is much less definitive. Oh. And I don't know how you make it a definitive statement of, I'm in the race, I'm staying in the race. And I guess the way you do that is to have the Democrats coalesce around you, which, assuming, we hope would happen at the convention, but maybe not.
Or you get out, and unfortunately, you run as if you're 30 years younger than you are, that you're out in front, you're
but
in
is
big
that possible?
Rally. No, you see, and this yeah. is and this yeah. is the problem. But that is what the public is looking for. What I'm looking for is a level of vibrancy that will overcome my doubt about your
That's
capacity
right.
to hold this position.
Yeah.
So I want to see you out there. I want to see you aggressive. I want to see you fighting. I want to see you, I want to see the passion and the fire and the capacity. And when you hear that, you know, even on a call with his own allies, it is being so tightly scripted that they're looking for the questions beforehand.
Yeah, that's disturbing.
That is super disturbing to me.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to some letters here. We go to Teresa, who writes, Bob, thanks for bringing up the Elon Musk issue. According to media reports, the two strongest advocates for J.D. Vance were Elon Musk and Tucker Carlson in chorus with Trump's son. They're doing this for a reason, and that needs attention.
Yeah.
We go to
talk about the triumvirate that's going to run this country if Trump gets elected, right?
Well, and we're seeing that during the RNC.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, writes Marilyn, if sane America doesn't see through or understand the threat posed by the former guy and Project 2025 and choose to throw all that away because they are not entertained enough by the candidate, we are already lost. Yes, it may be frustrating about the current state of affairs, but the Democratic platform is forward-thinking and addresses real issues. We need to vote. I'm voting for my daughter, who, due to the former guy and the corrupt Supreme Court, now has less rights than guns in this country.
Yep.
If people can feel inspired about protecting our country from autocratic theocracy, then we aren't America anyway. Then we go to this letter from Ashley. Does the panel have any suggestions for voters concerned that Biden won't step back and the GOP will gain all branches of government? For example, are there ways for calls or letters to reach Biden's inner circle? How can we make our voices and votes known? That's a great question from Ashley. But again, going back, you have poll. The president of the United States keeps on saying 15 million people voted for me in the primary against a nobody candidate, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 76% of the people polled in several different polls say that he's too old and should not be the candidate. Other than that, I don't know. Like, the information's out there.
I mean, all I can say is the only option we have to voice our opinions is to contact our state representatives and state senators and pressure and pressure and pressure them to pursue an alternative. That is it. I don't know what else that can be done.
Peter said, a solid president because of the people around him, a weak candidate because he stands alone. That from Peter. I mean, the argument is you have great people around you, so we don't have to worry as much about Biden as we should. But we're voting for him, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is not how democracy works. We don't have great people on the inner circle, because if the Republicans do that, the great people on the inner circle are Elon Musk, Eric Trump,
and Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson. There's their great people on the inner circle. Now think about that.
Chris writes, thank you for this morning's important discussion. It seems to me that the stakes are much higher this election, more than the next 4 years are at risk. Now that we know the GOP ticket, the next 12 years plus are at risk. Our dear President Biden can put all this to rest by taking advantage of the excellent medical resources at his disposal to undertake meaningful cognitive testing and to silence his critics. Please take the tests and put this to rest. Then we go to Ashley. Does the panel have any? Oh, I read that. Yeah. I apologize. That's bad collating on my part.
Nothing to do with cognitive decline. It's just bad collating.
Eric says, since Trump currently seems unbeatable, would it be smarter to focus on the House and Senate, or are they a lost cause as well?
Well, I think that unfortunately they go hand in hand. If people aren't excited about Biden, then they're less likely to vote. And so even if they would have voted for, say, Josh Riley or Pat Ryan or some of the flippable seats, even just in New York State alone, you know, now they're not going to show up and now we might lose these seats. So, I mean, yeah, we can focus on them. But like if you focus on electing the president, it has a trickle down effect, unlike economics that doesn't work when you trickle it down.
All right.
And you know, I want to say, go ahead.
I just don't think we're done with all of the twists and turns for this election. Even if Biden stays in, I think what we're going to be talking about is going to be different in September than.
Right. I was going to say it's never a lost cause. It's only, I mean, it only is a lost cause if all of us stay home, never talk about politics, never push back, never engage with community. It is never a lost cause. I mean, think about voters in Poland. They fought back against the right wing and they succeeded. Young people going out and talking to their elderly relatives and pushing and pushing and pushing. We have to do the same. We have to be organized. We have to pursue our goals. We have to speak to people and our neighbors and our friends and in friend circles about what is really going on.
Yeah, I think that right now we're kind of all nervous and having like a collective panic attack because we feel like this is the last chance to switch it out. And I hope that if we decide not to switch it out, that we do have that moment where we're like, okay, well, we just have to coalesce around Biden because this is our guy. And, you know, so if it does go to someone else because this is our last moment and we do decide to switch it out, then great. I'm behind anyone. But, you know, I think that we need to just work to elect anyone that gets it.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'll finish up the letters and we'll finish up our time together on this Wednesday morning. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Let's go around with our panel this morning. Welcome back. I'm Joe Donahue, Vera Karius-Kelly, Bob Griffin, who wants to say something, and I'll let him. And Anna Markowitz with us. Go, Bob.
You know, if I could say something to Joe Biden, I would say, go talk to Nancy Pelosi, who had the courage to step back from being the most powerful speaker in our history, because she recognized that it was time for change and the institution needed it and was right for the institution, not what was right for Nancy Pelosi. So there are actually models that should be held up for Joe and his people.
But I agree with you, but from reporting, she has gone to him and has expressed her concerns as to why it is not.
Which is part of why you hear such frustration in my voice, because then it's like, you know, Joe and Jill and whoever's talking. I mean, it's like, become about you, not what's become of what's right for the country.
That's right.
My favorite line today was, Hunter is your life coach.
Yes. Okay.
That is really, truly, when you think about that, the most fundamentally scary thing. The guy makes nothing but bad choices.
Yeah.
Let's see. Letters quickly while we... TikTok time here. It is often said that it is up to Biden whether or not he gets out of the race. Actually, it's up to the voters. If Biden stays in, I fear many voters will just check out. Then Kathy writes, there is much talk about a replacement candidate for Biden based on recognition and reputation. Think of the impact of almost any other candidate. A tremendous change in the energy from our present dynamic. It would energize us like nothing else. An option for the undecided without 4 years of media baggage.
And I have a sense that Trump selected J.D. Vance in part because of the potential of a younger Democratic candidate. So he wanted an attack dog in his vein who looked significantly younger. I mean, he's 39, so he's decades younger, in case the Democrats were going to come up with somebody else.
Let's see. Ellen writes, I think Mark Kelly could win. Were you talking to Teresa Bourgeois? and who'll be with us on Friday, by the way. Kyle writes, I read this letter quickly and I didn't understand it, so I'll read it slower and maybe I will understand it. But Joe said that Biden's claim that he's the only one who can beat Trump is enraging those out there who could do it. Could you be specific about who has said that they were enraged? And could those who could do it, Biden has the campaign money, the incumbency, support from unions, et cetera. It doesn't sound like a vain boast on his part, but a judgment based in very real logistics, whether true or not. Well, I think he's looking, my reading of this is that the case that's being made by Joe Biden is that I'm the only one who can do it because these are all the great things that I've done over the last 3 years, and which many are undeniable. These are the things that I want to continue to do. Okay, you have a plan. But then that is versus, are you able to win? One. Two, are you able to actually do what you said that you want to do?
I get upset because it shows a level of hubris and arrogance that I don't normally associate with Joe Biden. The country is bigger than one person. That's the crap I hear from Donald Trump. That's not the crap I expect to hear from Joe Biden. There's a deep bench in the Democratic Party, and there are lots of other people who I think could do the job as well.
Agreed.
During the George Stephanopoulos interview, he said, the Lord Almighty would be the person that will be the entity to come and to get him not to run. Which brings us to Jennifer's letter, who says, okay, how about the Pope? Is that good enough? Well, ask the Pope to call Joe Biden to convince him to step down.
I don't think that's going to go over well.
I know, but it's good out-of-the-box thinking Jennifer, I think. Let's see. One more letter here. And the notion that voters who care about reproductive rights, global warming, health care, Social Security, et cetera, will turn out because they don't like the presidential candidate says more about us as a citizen than it does about Biden. What the heck do people think will happen when they don't turn out? Folks should stop whining and work to turn back the tide of right-wing Christian nationalism, period.
Agreed. Because, I mean, in so many ways, people do not pay attention to policies. They just pay attention to slogans and appearances and gestures and shouting and performance art. This is not where your life is going to be affected. It is in the weeds of policies. How do you feel about somebody like Trump not wanting to support Social Security in the long run? How do you feel about your daughter or granddaughter not being able to access health care the way we're used to today, or were used to today until recently? How do you feel about our economy being misguided in a direction that allows inflation to rise because we no longer import, we no longer have good relations with other countries, we no longer trade the way we used to? There are lots of very detailed issues, including the environment. I mean, we see all these storms, we see global warming, we see young people concerned about that. What about all these issues that Trump pushes aside and says, not my problem, the next generation can deal with it?
And we only have 4 minutes left, but we haven't talked a lot about all of the obstacles the Republican Party has put in the way of voters in many, many states. So when you combine, it's going to be harder to vote, they've made it they have really, really jerry-rigged the system.
And gerrymandered,
too. Gerrymandered the system as well as jerry-rigged the system. When you pair that with a lack of enthusiasm, that you start to see where some of these seeds mm-hmm. are coming together in really bad ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and just in the fact that his vice president pick has said that he wouldn't confirm the election if
that.
A Democrat won in 2028. Mm-hmm. I mean, that alone, like, do we want to not live in a democracy? That seems to be, we're giving him a second chance to try January 6th again.
Yes.
And that is enough for me personally. Yeah. And I wish it was enough for most people.
And I find it quite amazing that the Brazilian managed to turn the tide towards democracy again after Bolsonaro tried, you know, a version of overthrowing the government. But we in the United States can seem to identify what's a criminal act, what is treason, what is, attacking the foundation of our institutions. I mean, it is truly shocking. I think a lot of people need to pay a lot closer attention to what is happening. And my goal is not to live in a dictatorship. I had family live in dictatorship in the past, in East Germany and in Nazi Germany. I do not want anything like that to happen to us.
Vericarious Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Anna Markowitz, I thank you so much for being with us and for your brilliance and advice and thoughtful comments. I appreciate it more than you know. We'll continue with another hour of the Roundtable after this short break.